and seemed to regret he had shaved that morning.
"He told me they was two proper tubs of gin, and both same brand, Markie. That's what's powerful strange. Both same brand. Seems to me as if someone's been tampering with this one. I wonder who could be."
"I've a damnation thundering good notion," said Mark Daniel,
who had already drunk 3 pints of port, and had just been ready to get down to the serious work of the evening.
"No need to get in a paw about him," said Judd,
sweating.
"'Tas naught to do with me. There ain't no proof of nothing. Nobody can't say where the fault do lay. Anybody could have tankered with him. That's if so be as somebody has, which if they has, I doubt. But I suspicion 'tis the Frenchy. Never trust a Frenchy, I say. That Frenchy at Roscoff, he'd a look all right, he'd a talk all right, but do he act all right? He'd a look he in the eye like a Christian, but what do that surmount to? Only that he's two-faced like the rest, but more so. When I was attacker,"
said old man Greet, perseveringly,
"they had some proper gin down to Saw Village, where Aunt Tams in Nampusker lived. She that died in 58 fell down a shaft, she did, when she was well gone in liquor. I'm not surprising when—"
"Yes, I well remember old Aunt Tamsin," said Nick Vigus incautiously. "She rode down Stippy Stappy Lane one day on the back of her old sow, with all the little uns wagging away behind. Regular procession, 'twas. Some drink old Aunt Tamsin had to put away."
"Damn!"
roared Mark Daniel.
"If I don't see it all now, that's where I tasted him before. It is Nick's doing. It is all Nick's doing. We're suspicioning the wrong man. You caught a mind that poison brew Nick Vigus did hatch in his own back kitchen out of devil knows what, to sell to the poor fools with money to burn last Michaelmas fair. Gin, he called it. You recollect? Well, it was near enough a taste of this to be brother and twin to un."
"Aye,"
said Will Nanfan.
"Aye, that's truth. God's truth, for I drank some myself and wished I'd never touched un. It give a twist to your innards, a twist like a reefer knot. Nick Vigus has cheated, we."
Vigus's sly, pockmarked face went red and white by turns, as the accusing stares focused themselves on him. Mark Daniel took another sup to be sure, and then went to the window and sprayed it about the vegetable bed.
"Pah! The very same, or I'm a heathen. Nick Vigus, you're a damnation crawling cheat, and it is time ye was learned a lesson."
He began to roll up his sleeves, showing his great hairy forearms. Nick backed away, but Paul Daniel blocked his escape to the door. There was some horseplay, then Mark Daniel took a firm grip and turned Vigus upside down and stood him on his head.
"'Twas none of my doing," Nick shouted. "Judd Painter were the one. Judd Painter come to me last week and said to me, he said, 'Don't believe a word of un,'" Judd said loudly. "I'm an honest man, as ye all to know. Not given to tankering with a word of truth, but Nick's a greasy liar, as ye all to know, and would sell his mother to save his skin off his nose, and as ye all to know."
"Shaken up, Mark," Zacky said. "We shall be getting at the truth by and by."
"Judd come to me last week and says to me, he says, 'Can he make us some of your gin, boy? 'Cause that there tub I was keeping, all the gin has runned away into the ground. Turn me right face up, Mark, or I shall smother.'"
Mark gripped his victim more firmly round the middle, and with a great heave stamped his kicking feet upon one of the beams of the cottage ceiling.
"Come, my dear," he said gently, "speak up. for else ye may die unshrived.
He says all the gin has runned away into the ground on account of the rats had gnawed away a hole in the tub. Ah! Ah! And on account of he didn't want to disappoint thee. Would I make...
Catch him, Paul!
Will Nanfan shouted, as Judd Painter, like an obsequious bulldog, tried to leave unnoticed. They caught him in the doorway, and a great deal of heaving and muttering went on before the elder Daniel and Will Nanfan came back with him.
"'Tadn't true!'
shouted Judd, toothless with indignation.
"'You're barking up the wrong door! What for he to want to take that man's word afore mine? Tadn't fair, tadn't just, tadn't British! I dare swear if the truth be known that he stole half the tub for hisself.' Why blame a man ye know wouldn't rob? If I had half, you had the rest,
came from the upended Vigus.
Let me get'n,
swore Judd, suddenly struggling.
I'll tear his breeches off. Let me face her and have an out. Ye pack of cowards, 2-1. Let me get at un. I'll face ye 1-1, ye cowards. Take your hands off me and I'll... Poo me! I'll poo me! Wait a while and I'll poo ye myself,
said Mark Daniel.
Man to man as ye'd like, see? Now out of the way, boys!
He carried Nick Vigus still inverted to the door. Unfortunately, at this moment some of the women, hearing the uproar, had left the other cottage and reached this door led by Mrs. Vigus. On seeing her husband presented to her at an unusual angle, she let out a piercing scream and rushed forward to the rescue. But Mark fended her off and carried Nick across to the cottage of Joe and Betsy Triggs. At the back of this was a slimy green pool which contained, among other things, most of their sewage. Since Reuben Clemo had disappeared, this had held pride of place for smells in the neighbourhood. At the brink of the water, Mark sharply upended the half-choked man, grasped him by the seat of his breeches, and flung him on his face into the middle of the pool. Mark breathed deeply and spat on his hands.
"Now for the next of 'un," he said.
And thither also Judd Painter went in his turn. As Ross rode home from Truro that evening, in the gathering windy dusk, he thought of the two young people who were starting life together. If the mine were started, he would offer Jim a surface job, some sort of clerical work, perhaps, which would give him a better chance. His outing today had been to do with Wheel Leisure. After buying things for the house, flour and sugar, mustard and candles, huckaback linen for towels, a new pair of riding boots for himself, and a brush and comb, he had called on Mr. Nathaniel Pierce, the notary. Mr. Pierce, as effusive, as purple, and as gouty as ever, sitting in an armchair poking the fire with a long iron curtain rod, listened with interest. Mr. Pierce said, "Well now, and how pleasant, and I declare a most tackable suggestion." Mr. Pierce scratched at a louse under his wig while his eyes grew speculative. Was Captain Henshaw investing some of his own money? Dear, dear, now Captain Henshaw's reputation was high in the Truro district. Well now, dear sir, speaking as an indigent notary, he personally had only a little free capital. But there were, as Captain Poldark suggested, a certain number of his clients who were always on the lookout for a good speculative investment. He would be willing to give the matter his further consideration and see what could be done. Events were moving slowly, but movement there was, and the momentum would increase. In a couple of months, they might be sinking the first shaft. As he led the mare into the stable and unbuckled the saddle, he wondered whether to offer Charles and Francis a share. He had come home at a good pace to reach the house before dark, and Darkie was steaming and sweaty. She was unsettled too, and did not want to keep still while he wiped her down. For that matter, the other horses showed the same uneasiness, Ramoth kept tossing his old head and whinnying. He wondered if there was a snake in the stable, or a fox in the loft above. The pale square of the stable door still let in some light, but he could see nothing in the shadows. He patted Ramoth's soft old nose and returned to his task. This done, he gave Darkie her feed and turned to leave. Near the door were the steps to the loft where Carter had slept. As he glanced up there, something grazed past his head and struck him a numbing blow on the shoulder. He fell to his knees, and there was a thud on the straw of the floor. Then he got quickly to his feet again, staggered to the door, was through it, and leaning with his back to it, holding his shoulder. For a few seconds the pain made him feel sick, but it began to pass. He felt his shoulder and could find no broken bone. The thing which had struck him still lay on the floor inside the stable, but he had seen what it was, and that was why he had moved so quickly into the open. It was the rock drill, the iron jumper he had last seen in the hands of Reuben Clemo. They were all in the kitchen when he went in. With a piece of coarse thread and a large bent needle, Demelza was trying to mend a tear in her skirt. Judd was sitting back in a chair, with a look of patient suffering on that part of his face which was not hidden by a large bandage. Prudy was drinking tea.
"Why, Captain Ross?"
said Judd, in a weak and trembling voice.
"We didn't hear he come. Shall I go and wipe down the horse?"
"I have done that. Why are you back from the wedding so soon? What is wrong with your face? Prudy, keep my supper for 10 minutes. I have something to see to."
"The wedding is over," said Judd. "'Twas a poor affair. A more poorer affair never I saw. Naught but Martins and Carters, the whole dashed-danged blathering boiling of them, and a few of the riff-raff of the mines. I thought better of Zaki than to invite such a poor lot of folk. Out of my element I was."
"Is aught amiss, sir?"
Demelza asked. Ross stared at her. "Amiss? No, what should there be?"
"And on the way back," Judd said, "hard by Wheel Grace, I turned me heel upon a stone and fell."
But Ross had walked through into the house.
"You best keep your tongue still when he's in one of them moods,"
Judd said severely to Demelza.
"Or 'twon't be only your father you'll be getting a cuff from. Interrupting of your elders shows you been bad brought up."
Demelza gazed at him wide-eyed, but did not reply. Ross could not see his gun in the parlour, but found it in his bedroom. There he carefully loaded and primed it, and pulled back the hammer to half-cock. He had bolted the door of the stable, so there should be no escape this time. He felt as if he had cornered a mad dog. In the gathering darkness, he lit a storm lantern, and this time left the house by the front door, making a circuit of the building to reach the stable. Better not leave the man too long, or he might do some hurt to the horses. Quietly, he drew the bolt of the door and waited for a gust of wind to die before lifting the latch. Then he pushed the door wide, entered, put the lantern down just out of the draught, and stepped away into the shadows of the stalls. Darkie whinnied at his sudden entry. Wind blew in, disturbing the straw and leaves. A bat fluttered away from the light. There was silence. The iron bar had gone.
"Reuben," Ross said, "come out. I want to talk to you."
No reply. He hadn't expected one. You could hear the fluttering of the bat's wings as it circled in the darkness. He went on into the stable. As he reached the second horse, he thought he heard a move behind him, and turned swiftly, his gun up. But nothing stirred. He wished now he had brought the lantern farther, for its feeble light did not reach the deeper shadows. Squire moved suddenly, stamping his hooves on the floor. All the horses knew there was mischief about. Ross waited 5 minutes, tense by the stall, knowing that now it was a test of patience, of whose nerve would stand the longest. He was sure of his own. But as time passed, he found that sureness urging him to go on. The man might have gone back to the loft with his weapon. He might be cowering there, prepared to see the night through. Ross heard Judd come out of the house and tramp across the cobbles. He thought at first he might be coming here, but heard him enter the earth closet next door. Presently, he went back to the house, and the door was shut. Still no movement in the stable. Ross turned to go back for the lantern, and as he did, there was a hum of air behind him, and a crash as the jumper was swung and hit the partition where he had been standing. Wood splintered, and he turned and fired straight into the figure which came up in the darkness. Something hit him across the head, and the figure was making for the door. As the man was outlined, he pulled the trigger again. But this time, the touch powder did not ignite. Before he could pull back the cock, Reuben Clemo was gone. He ran to the door and stared out. A figure moved beside the apple trees, and he discharged the second barrel at it. Then he wiped a trickle of blood from his forehead and turned towards the house, from which Judd and Prudy and Demelza were just issuing in alarm. He was angry and frustrated at the man's escape, even though there was every likelihood of his being found in the morning. It would be very difficult for him not to leave a trail. Chapter 13. He was out at dawn following the bloodstains which Clemo had left behind. But just before they reached Melin, they turned north towards the sand hills, and he lost track of them. In the days that followed, nothing more was heard of the man, and the most reasonable conclusion was that he had lain down somewhere, in that waste of sand, and died of weakness and exposure. It was well to be finally rid of him, and nobody asked any questions. The fact that he had ever reappeared became a secret kept by the four members of the Nampara household, and Zaki, whom Ross told. During the months of that summer, the house of Nampara was seldom without flowers. This was Demelza's doing. She was always up at dawn, and, now that the dread of being kidnapped and taken home for a thrashing had left her, she wandered at will in the fields and lanes, the lolloping Garrick trailing at her heels, to return with a big bunch of wild flowers, which found their way into the parlour. Prudy had tried to break her of the habit, since it was not the duty of a kitchen maid to brighten up the house with her gleanings. But Demelza went on bringing in the flowers, and her obstinacy and Prudy's inertia won the day. Sometimes it was a bunch of meadowsweet and ragged robin, sometimes an armful of foxgloves or a posy of sea pinks. If Ross ever noticed these, he made no comment. The child was like a young animal which had spent 14 years in blinkers, narrowing her gaze to the smallest domestic circle and the most primitive purposes. The first 9 years linked closely to her mother, in a succession of illnesses and ill-treatment and poverty and childbirths, the last 5 facing all except the last alone. It was not surprising now that she expanded in body and in mind. She grew an inch in 4 months, and her interest in flowers was a symbol of her widening outlook. She had taken to combing her hair and tying it back, where it sometimes stayed, so that her features had come out into the open. She was not an ill-looking girl, and had a good clear skin, and a quick mobility of expression. Her eyes were intelligent and very frank. In another couple of years, some young miner like Jim Carter would be courting her. She was a very quick learner, and something of a mimic, so that she began to add words to her vocabulary, and to know how to pronounce them. She also began to lose some. Ross had consulted Prudy, always a flattering way of approach, and Prudy, who could outswear a trooper when she chose, found herself committed to the reduction of Demelza's curse words. Sometimes, faced by Demelza's probing questions, Prudy felt as if she were in a trap. Prudy knew what was right and proper, and Demelza did not. And it might be possible to teach some girls to behave themselves without taking care of your own behaviour, but Demelza was not one of them. She was much too quick in her conclusions. Her thoughts raced ahead and met one on the rebound. So the process became not merely the willing education of Demelza, but the unwilling regeneration of Prudy. It was not possible, she found, even to get drunk decently these days. Ross looked on with amusement. Even Judd was not immune, but he bore the situation less graciously than his wife. He seemed to consider it an added grievance that she had not hit him with a broom handle for more than 2 months. It was not a question of their being reformed by contact with the pure and lovely spirit of a child, for the child had as much original sin as they had. If Demelza grew and developed, Garrick was a beanstalk. When he came, he had been more of a puppy than anyone thought, and with proper food, he enlarged so rapidly that one began to suspect the sheepdog in his ancestry. The sparse black curls of his coat remained, and his lack of tail made him curiously clumsy and unbalanced. He took a great fancy to Judd, who couldn't bear the sight of him, and the ungainly dog followed the bald old rascal everywhere. In July, Garrick was pronounced free of parasites and admitted to the kitchen. He celebrated his entry by bounding across to Judd at the table and upsetting a jug of cider in his lap. Judd got up in a flood of cider and self-pity and aimed the jug at the dog, which scuttled out again, while Demelza fled into the dairy and covered her head with her hands in a paroxysm of laughter. One day, to Ross's surprise, he received a visit from Mrs. Teague and her youngest daughter, Ruth. They had ridden over to Mingus, Mrs. Teague explained, and thought it sociable to call in at Nampara on the way home. Mrs. Teague had not visited Nampara for nearly 10 years, and was so interested, she said, to see how Ross was managing for himself. Farming was such an engaging hobby, Mr. Teague had always said. "More than a hobby with me, Mum," Ross said. He had been mending the fence, which bounded part of his land, and was dirty and dishevelled, his hands scarred and soiled and rusty. When he greeted them in the parlour, the contrast with Mrs. Teague's overbright riding costume could not be ignored. Ruth, too, was got up to kill today. Looking at her while they drank the cordial he ordered for them, he saw what it was that had taken him at the ball. The latent prettiness of the slightly rouged mouth, the unusual oblique set of her grey-green eyes, the lift of her wilful little chin. With some last despairing effort, Mrs. Teague had put a vitality into her youngest daughter that the others lacked. They talked prettily about this and that. They had really been to call at the invitation of Mr. John Treneglis, the eldest son of Mr. Horace Treneglis, of Mingus. John was master of the Carnbarrow hunt, and had expressed supreme admiration for the way Ruth rode. He had invited them over so often that at last they felt impelled to gratify his request. What a noble house Mingus was it not? "The Gothic style and so very spacious," said Mrs. Teague, looking round. Mr. Treneglis was a most charming old gentleman. One could not help but notice how frail he had become. How disappointing that Captain Poldark did not ride to hounds. Would it not do him a great matter of benefit, the mixing with other people of his own station and the thrill of the chase? Ruth always rode. It was her abiding passion. Not, of course, that she was not highly accomplished in the gentler arts. One had to taste her syllabubs to know their richness. She had always believed, Mrs. Teague said, in bringing up her children to be accomplished about the house, This piece of lace, which she wore as a fichu, had been made entirely by Ruth and Joan, though Joan had not the industry of her younger sister. During all this, Ruth looked uncomfortable, pouting her mouth and glancing obliquely about the room and tapping her riding whip against one of her small, well-shod feet. But when her mother was otherwise occupied, she found the opportunity to send him some knowledgeable and inviting looks. Ross thought of the few hours of daylight left and realized he would not complete the repair of the fence today. "Did he see much of the rest of the family?" Mrs. Teague asked. There had not been a single Poll Dark at the Lemon Ball. Of course, one could not expect Elizabeth to go about so much as usual, now that she was expecting a confinement. Ruth blushed, and a sharp stab of pain went through Ross. Was it true, Mrs. Teague wondered, that Verity was still meeting that man, that Captain Blamey, somewhere in spite of her father's veto? One heard the rumour. No, well, of course, Ross wouldn't know. With being so much out of touch with the world. At 5:30, they rose to go. They thanked him, but would not stay to supper. It had been agreeable seeing him. Would he come over to visit them, if they wrote, fixing a day? Very well. One day at the beginning of next month. He had made Nampara most comfortable again. One felt, perhaps, that the touch of a woman's hand was needed to set it off, to give it graciousness and gentility. Did he not ever feel that way? They moved to the front door, Mrs. Teague chatting amiably, Ruth sulky and sweet by turns, trying to catch his eye and re-establish the flirtatious companionship of the ball. Their manservant brought their horses forward. Ruth mounted first, lightly and easily. She had the grace of youth and of the born horsewoman. She sat in the saddle as if made for it. Mrs. Teague then mounted, satisfied with his approving glances, and he walked with them as far as the boundary of his land. On the way, Demelza passed them. She was carrying a basket of pilchards from Saul, where the first catch of the season had just been landed. She was in the better of her two frocks of pink printed dimity, and the sun shone on her tousled hair. A child, a girl, thin and angular, with a long-legged stride. And then she raised her unexpected eyes. She blinked once, curtsied awkwardly, passed on. Mrs. Teague took out a fine lace handkerchief and flicked a little dust from her habit.
"I heard you had, adopted a child, Captain Poldark. That is she?"
"I have adopted no one," Ross said. "I needed a kitchen wench. The child is old enough to know her own mind. She came. That is all there is about it."
"A nice little thing," said Mrs. Teague. "Yes, she looks as if she would know her own mind."
The affairs of Verity and Captain Blamey came to a head at the end of August. It was unfortunate that this should occur on the day Ross had accepted Mrs. Teague's invitation to return her call. Verity had met Andrew Blamey 4 times at Nampara during the summer, once each time he was ashore. Ross could not bring himself to dislike the seaman, for all his history. A quiet man, with no small talk, a man with self-possessed eyes, offset by an unusual modesty of bearing. The word one would instinctively choose to describe him was sober. Yet sober was the last thing he had once been, if one merely accepted his own confession. Sometimes it was possible to sense a conflict. He had the reputation, Ross knew, for being a driver aboard his ship, and in the deliberate self-control, the self-containment of all his movements, one caught the echo of past struggles and guessed the measure of the victory won. His deference and tenderness towards Verity were obviously sincere. If there was anyone he could dislike, it was himself and the role he was playing. He was abetting the meeting of 2 people
whom common sense would emphasize were better apart. If things went wrong, he would be more to blame than anyone else. One could not expect clear-sightedness from two people deeply in love. Nor was he at all comfortable about the progress of events. He was not present at their interviews, but he knew Blamey was trying to persuade Verity to run away with him, and that so far, Verity had not brought herself to the point of agreement. Still hoping that there might be a reconciliation between Andrew and her father. She had, however, agreed to go with him to Falmouth sometime soon and meet his children, and Ross had a suspicion that if she went she would not return. One could not go so far in a few minutes and be back without anyone being the wiser. This would be the thin end of defiance. Once there, he would persuade her to marry him rather than come back and face the storm. The week before, Mrs. Teague had sent a letter by one of her grooms inviting him to a small afternoon party they were holding next Friday at 4. Heaping abuse on himself, he wrote out an acceptance while the man waited. The next day, Verity came over to ask if she might meet Andrew Blamey at Nampara on Friday afternoon at 3. There was no need for Ross to be in while they met, except a convention which, knowing Verity, he didn't subscribe to. So he raised no objection, and only delayed long enough to welcome them. Having seen them into the parlour and left word they were not to be disturbed, he got his horse and rode up the valley, casting regretful eyes about at all the work he might have been doing instead of riding away to play at foppery with half a dozen silly young men and women. At the head of the valley, just beyond Wheal Maiden, he met Charles and Francis. For a moment he was put out.
"A pleasure to welcome you on my land, Uncle," he said. "Were you thinking to pay me a visit? Another 5 minutes and you would have found me away."
"That was our intention," said Francis shortly.
Charles jerked his horse's head up. They were both looking flushed and angry.
"There's a rumour afoot that Verity is meeting that Blamey fellow at your house, Ross. We are riding over to discover the truth of it."
"I'm afraid I can't offer you my hospitality this afternoon," Ross said. "I have an engagement at 4, at some distance."
"Verity's at your house now," said Francis. "We intend going down to see if Blamey is there, whether you like it or not."
"Arf," said Charles. "There's no need to be unpleasant, Francis. Perhaps we are mistaken. Give us your word of honour, boy, and we'll ride back without the need of a quarrel."
"Well, but what is she doing there?"
Francis asked truculently.
Ross said, "Since my word of honour would not remove Captain Blamey, I can't give it."
He watched Charles's expression change.
"God damn you, Ross, have you no sense of decency? No loyalty to your family? Leaving her down there with that son of a whore?"
"I told you it was so,"
Francis exclaimed, and without waiting for further talk, turned his horse at a trot down the valley towards Nampara.
"I think you misjudge the man," Ross said slowly.
Charles snorted.
"I think I have misjudged you."
He followed his son. Ross watched them nearing the house with an unpleasant premonition of ill. Their words and looks left no doubt of the attitude they would take. He pulled at Darkie's head and followed in their wake. When he reached the house, Francis was already in the parlour. He could hear the raised voices as Charles slid laboriously from his horse. When they got inside, Captain Blamey was standing beside the fireplace, one hand on Verity's sleeve, as if to stop her from coming between him and Francis. He was in his captain's laced coat of fine blue cloth, with a white wing collar and black cravat. He wore his most self-contained look, as if all unruly passion were locked away, bolted and unreachable, guarded by all the controls of his own choosing and testing. He looked sturdy and middle-aged,
against the flushed, handsome arrogance of Francis's youth. Ross noticed that Charles was carrying his riding whip.
"No way to speak to your sister," Blamey was saying. "Any hard words you've a mind to speak can come to me." "Dirty skunk," Charles said, "sneaking behind our backs. My only daughter."
"Sneaking," said Blamey, "because you would not meet to talk over the matter. Do you think..."
"Talk it over?" said Charles. "There's nothing to talk over with wife murderers. We don't like 'em in this district. They leave a nasty stink in the nostrils. Verity, get your horse and go home."
She said quietly, "I have a right to choose my own life."
"Go, dear," said Blamey. "It's no place for you now."
She shook off his hand.
"I stay."
"Then stay and be damned," said Francis. "There's only one way of treating your sort, Blamey. Words and honour don't count. Perhaps a thrashing will."
He began to take off his coat.
"Not on my land," said Ross. "Begin any brawl here, and I'll throw you off it myself."
There was a moment's nonplussed silence.
"God's name!" exploded Charles. "You have the impudence to take his side?"
"I take no one's side, but you won't change the issue with horseplay."
"One skunk and another," said Francis. "Your small matter better than he is." "You heard what your sister said," Captain Blamey interposed quietly. "She has the right to choose her own life. I have no wish to quarrel, but she is coming away with me."
"I'll see you in hell first," Francis said. "There'll be no cleaning of your boots on our family."
Captain Blamey suddenly went very white.
"You insolent puppy."
"Puppy, is it now?"
Francis leaned forward and smacked Captain Blamey with an open hand across his cheek. The red mark showed, and then Blamey hit Francis in the face, and Francis went to the floor. There was a brief pause. Verity had backed away from them both, her face small and sick. Francis sat up, and with the back of his hand wiped a streak of blood from his nose. He got to his feet.
"When will it be convenient for you to meet me, Captain Blamey?"
Having found outlet, the seaman's anger had ebbed. But somehow his composure was not the same. If only for a moment, the controls had been broken.
"I leave for Lisbon by tomorrow's tide."
Francis's expression was contemptuous.
"That, of course, is what I would have expected."
"Well, there is still today."
Charles stepped forward.
"Nay, there's no call for these damned Frenchy methods, Francis. Let's thrash the beggar and then go."
"There'll be none of that, neither," said Ross.
Francis licked his lips.
"I demand satisfaction. You can't deny that. The fellow once laid claims to be a gentleman. Let him come outside and meet me if he's got the guts."
"Andrew," Verity said, "don't agree to anything."
The sailor glanced at the girl distantly, as if her brother's hostility had already separated them.
"Fight it out with fists," said Charles, stertorously. "The skunk's not worth the risk of a pistol ball, Francis."
"Nothing else will discourage him," said Francis. "I'll trouble you for weapons, Ross. If you refuse them, I'll send over to Trenwith for my own." "Send over then," snapped Ross. "I'll be no party to your bloodletting."
"They're on the wall behind you, man," said Blamey, between his teeth.
Francis turned and took down the silver dueling pistols with which Ross had threatened Demelza's father.
"Will they still fire?"
he said coldly, addressing Ross. Ross did not speak.
"Come outside, Blamey,"
Francis said.
"Look, boy," said Charles. "This is stuff and nonsense. It's my quarrel, and..."
"Nothing of the sort. He knocked me down.
Come away and have no truck with the varmint. Verity will come with us, won't you, Verity?
Yes, Father.
Francis looked at Ross.
Call your man and get him to see these pistols are properly primed.
Get him yourself.
There are no seconds, said Charles. There's no suitable arrangements. Formality. One needs no formality when stalking a crow.
They went outside. It was easy to see that Francis was determined to have his satisfaction. Blamey, white about the nostrils, stood apart, as if the business didn't concern him. Verity made a last appeal to her brother, but he snapped at her that some solution to her infatuation must be found, and he had chosen this one. Judd was outside, so there was no need to call him. He was visibly interested and impressed by the responsibility thrust on him. He had only seen such a thing once before, and that 30 years ago. Francis told him to act as referee and to count out 15 paces for them. Judd glanced at Ross, who shrugged.
Yes, sir. 15, did you say?
They were in the open space of grass before the house. Verity had refused to go indoors. She held to the back of the garden seat. The men stood back to back, Francis an inch or more taller, his fair hair glinting in the sun.
Ready, sir?
Aye.
Ross made a movement forward, but checked himself. The headstrong fool must have his way.
Then go! 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
As Judd counted, the two men paced away from each other, and a swallow dipped and swerved between them. At the word 15 they turned. Francis fired first and hit Blamey in the hand. Blamey dropped his pistol. He bent and picked it up with his left hand and fired back. Francis put up a hand to his neck and fell to the ground. Ross's thought as he went forward was, I should have stopped them. What will this mean to Elizabeth if Francis... He turned Francis over upon his back and ripped away the ruffles of his shirt. The ball had gone into the base of the neck, by the shoulder, but had not come out again. Ross lifted him and carried him into the house.
My God, said Charles, following helplessly with the others. The boy's dead, my boy.
Nonsense, Ross said. Judd, take Mr. Francis's horse and ride for Dr. Choke. Say there has been a shooting accident, not the truth, mind.
It is the hurt. Serious?
Captain Blamey said, with a handkerchief about his hand.
I... Get out of here, said Charles, empurpled. How dare you come into the house again?
Don't crowd about him, Ross urged, having laid Francis on the sofa. Prudy, get me some clean rags and a bowl of hot water.
Let me help, said Verity. Let me help. I can do something. I can...
No, no, leave him be. There was silence for some moments, until Prudy returned in haste with the bowl. Ross had kept the wound from bleeding excessively until now by pressing on it with his own coloured kerchief. Now he lifted this and pressed a damp cloth in its place. Francis winced and groaned.
He'll be all right, said Ross. Only give him room to breathe.
Captain Blamey picked up his hat and left the room. Outside, he sat a moment on the seat beside the front door and put his head in his hands.
God's blood! That gave me a fright, said Charles,
wiping his face and neck and under his wig.
I thought the boy was gone. A mercy the fellow didn't shoot with his right hand.
Perhaps then he would have missed more cleanly, Ross said. Francis turned and muttered and opened his eyes. It took some moments for full consciousness to return. The rancor had left his eyes.
Has the fellow gone?
Yes, said Ross. Francis grinned wryly.
I winged him. It was your pesky dueling arms, Ross. The sighting must be awry. Ach! Well, this will save the leeches for a week or two.
Outside in the garden, Verity had rejoined Andrew Blamey. He had withdrawn completely within himself. In the space of 15 minutes, their relationship had been irrevocably changed.
I must go, he said,
and they both at once noticed the pronoun.
It's better before he comes round.
Oh, my dear, if you could have shot wide, or not at all.
He shook his head, oppressed with the complex struggles of his own nature, and with the futility of trying to explain. She said,
This, I know it was his seeking, all this quarrel, but he is my brother, and it makes it so impossible for me.
He struggled to find the hope to argue.
In time it will cool, Verity. Our feelings can't change.
She did not answer, but sat with lowered head. He stared at her hard for some seconds.
Perhaps Francis was right. There has been only trouble. Perhaps I shouldn't ever have thought of you, have looked at you.
She said,
No, Francis wasn't right. But after this, there can never be any reconciling.
After a minute he got up.
Your hand, she said. Let me tie it.
It's only a scratch. A pity his aim wasn't better.
Can you ride? Your fingers?
Yes, I can ride.
She watched him walk round the house. He held his shoulders like an old man. He came back mounted.
Goodbye, my love. If there's nothing else, give me leave to keep the memory.
She watched him cross the stream and ride slowly up the valley until the image in her eyes was suddenly misted and smeared. Chapter 14. The whole party was back at Tremwith. Francis, temporarily patched, had ridden his horse home, and now Choke was with him, making a showy job of the dressing. Charles, belching wind and the remnants of his anger, had stumped off to his own room to take a vomit and rest until supper. Elizabeth had almost fainted at the sight of her husband, but recovering herself, she had flown up and downstairs to hasten Mrs. Tabb and Bartle in supplying Dr. Choke's needs and in tending to the wounded man's comfort. As would be the case all through her life, she had a store of nervous energy, unavailable at ordinary times, but able to serve her in sudden need. It was a fundamental reserve which a stronger person might never know. And Verity had gone to her room. She felt herself detached from this household, of which she had been a part for 25 years. She was among strangers. More than that, they were hostile strangers. They had drawn away from her, and she from them, for lack of understanding. In an afternoon she had shrunk inside herself. There would grow up a core of friendlessness and isolation. She pushed the bolt across the door and sat abruptly in the first chair. Her romance was over. Even though she rebelled against the fact, she knew that it was so. She felt faint and sick, and desperately tired of being alive. If death could come quietly and peacefully, she would accept it, would sink into it, as one sank into a bed, wanting only sleep and self-forgetfulness. Her eyes moved round the room. Every article in it was familiar, with the extreme unseeing intimacy of everyday association. Through the long sash window and the narrow window in the alcove, she had looked with the changing eyes of childhood and youth. She had looked out on the herb garden, and the yew hedge, and the three bent sycamores in all the seasons of the year, and in all the moods of her own growth.
She had seen frost draw its foliate patterns on the panes. Raindrops run down them like tears on old cheeks. The first spring sun shine dustily through them on the turkey rug and the stained oak boards. The old French clock on the carved pine chimneypiece, with its painted and gilt figures, like a courtesan from the days of Louis XIV, had been in the room all Verity's life. Its thin metallic bell had been announcing the hours for more than 50 years. When it was made, Charles was a thin strip of a boy, not a breathless, empurpled old man breaking up his daughter's romance. They had been together, child and clock, girl and clock, woman and clock, through illness and nightmare and fairy stories and daydreams, through all the monotony and the splendour of her life. Her eyes went on to the glass-topped display table with the carved legs, to the two pink satin bedroom chairs, the cane rocking chair, the stumpy brass candlesticks with the candles rising in steps, the pincushion, the embroidered work basket, the two-handled washing urn. Even the decorations of the room, the long damask curtains, the flock wallpaper with its faded crimson flowers on an ivory ground, the white plaster roses of the cornice and ceiling, had become peculiarly and completely her own. She knew that here in the privacy of her own room, where no man except her brother and her father ever came, she could give way, could lie on the bed and weep, could abandon herself to sorrow. But she sat on the chair and didn't move at all. There were no tears in her. The wound went too deep, or she was not so constituted to give way to it. Hers would be the perpetual ache of loss and loneliness, slowly dulled with time until it became a part of her character, a faint sourness tinged with withered pride. Andrew would be back in Falmouth by now, back in the lodging she had heard of but never seen. Through his quiet talk, she had seen the bleakness of his life ashore, the two rooms in the lodging house by the quay, the drab woman who looked after him. She had thought to change all that. They had planned to rent a cottage overlooking the bay, a place with a few trees and a small garden running down to the shingle beach. Though he had scarcely ever spoken of his first marriage, she had understood enough to be certain that much of the fault of the failure lay with her, however inexcusable on his side the end might have been. She had felt that she could make up for that first failure. With her busy hands and managing ability, and with their mutual love, she would have made for him a home such as he had not had before. Instead, this room, which had seen her grow to maturity, would see her dry up and fade. The gilt mirror in the corner would bear its dispassionate testimony. All these ornaments and furnishings would be her companions through the years to come. And she realized that she would come to hate them, if she didn't already hate them, as one hates the witnesses of one's humiliation and futility. She made a half-hearted attempt to shake herself out of this mood. Her father and brother had acted in good faith, true to their upbringing and principles. If as a result she remained at their beck and call until she was old, it was not fair to blame them for the whole. They thought they had saved her from herself. Her life in Trenwith would be more peaceful, more sheltered than as the wife of a social outcast. She was among relatives and friends. The long summer days were full of interest about the farm, the sowing, the haymaking, the harvesting, butter and cheeses to superintend, syrups and conserves to make. The winter ones were full too. Needlework in the evening, making curtains and samplers and stockings, spinning wool and flax with Aunt Agatha, brewing simples, playing at quadrille when there were guests, or helping Mr. Odgers to train the choir at Saul Church.
dosing the servants with possets when they were ill. This winter, too, there would be a newcomer in the house. If she had gone, Elizabeth would have been doubly lost. Francis would have found the well-run routine of the house suddenly out of joint. Charles would have no one to arrange his cushions, or see that his silver tankard was polished before each meal. For these, and 100 other small needs, the household depended on her. And if they did not repay her with overt thanks, they showed her a tacit affection and friendship she couldn't disregard. And if she had not found these duties irksome in the past, was it not just the first flush of disappointment which said they must be so in the future? So she might argue, but Andrew said no. Andrew, sitting now with his head in his hands, in the dismal lodgings in Falmouth. Andrew, next week in the Bay of Biscay. Andrew, tramping the streets of Lisbon by night, or next month back in his lodgings. Andrew, eating and drinking and sleeping and waking and being, said no. He had taken a place in her heart, or taken a part of her heart, and nothing would be the same again. Last year she had drifted on a tide of custom and habit. She might have so drifted, without protest, into a contented and unambitious middle age. But this year, from now on, she must swim against the stream, not finding stimulus in the struggle, but only bitterness and regret and frustration. She sat there in the room by herself until darkness came and the shadows of the room closed about her like comforting arms. Chapter 15. Wheel Leisure was not started that summer. After some hesitancy, Ross invited Francis to join them. Francis refused rather brusquely. But something more imponderable than that held up the project. The price of copper in the open market fell to £80 a ton. To begin a new seeking venture at such a time would be asking for failure. Francis mended rapidly from his neck wound, but Ross's part in Verity's love affair still rankled with him and his father. Rumour had it that Poldark and his young wife had been spending money at an extravagant rate, and now that Elizabeth did not go out much, Francis went everywhere with George Warleggan. Ross saw little of Verity, for during the rest of the summer she scarcely left Tremwith. He wrote to Mrs. Teague, apologising for his default. Owing to unforeseen and unavoidable circumstances, there was very little else he could say. He did not receive a reply. Later, he learned that the small party was Ruth's birthday party, at which he was to have been the guest of honour. It was by then too late to implement his apology, and the damage was done. After the postponement of the Wheel Leisure venture, Jim Carter left his employment. He was not the sort of young man to be a farm labourer all his life, and Grambler reclaimed him. He came to Ross one evening in August, after they had spent all day cutting a field of barley, and explained that Ginny would not be able to work at Grambler after Christmas, at least not for the time, and they could not afford to be without her earnings. So, as he had never felt better in his life, he had taken a tribute on the 40-fathom level.
"I'm proper sorry to be leaving, sir," he said. "But it's a good pitch. I know that. With luck, I shall make 30 or 35 shillings a month. And that's what we've got to think on. If we could stay on at the cottage, we'd like to pay rent for it."
"So you shall," said Ross. "When I think you can afford it. Don't be so generous with your money till you see if it goes round."
"No, sir," said Jim, inarticulately. "'Twasn't exactly that."
"I know, boy. I'm not blind. Nor, by the way, am I deaf. I heard it whispered that you had been out poaching the other night with Nick Vigus." Jim went crimson. He stammered and seemed about to deny it, then abruptly said, "Yes." "It's a dangerous pastime," Ross said. "Whose land did you go on?"
Treneglas. Ross suppressed a smile.